So here we are, the first of five two-hour sessions for the Positive Psychology course. My name's Steve Draper. A little later on I'll talk about the structure of the course, but first up, let's begin with you summoning to your mind about your current idea about what happiness is. So begin by scribbling down a private note with your thought without consulting someone else. So no talking to your neighbours until you've had a private thought and she or he has had a private thought. Pleasure. Distinct from that is joy, which I take to be the emotion when something unexpectedly good happens, since when you get your first job offer, you'll probably have a burst of that. If you want to see, if you want to go and observe joy, though, probably a sports event is the classic place for both joy and unhappiness, because most sporting events are designed so that people can't predict the outcome very well. And so you get the reaction to the event which couldn't be predicted. The question, though, is whether happiness is distinct from that. Quite a lot of you were assessing a much longer time span than I think goes with basic emotion. The last thing, though, to attempt to integrate into understanding distinctions in this area is what you might call well-being. Because although a lot of studies strongly imply it relates to physical health, actually I think a lot of it is unconscious, really. So those are starting points. I'm going to talk briefly about some classic studies on gratitude in this area. And the reason for doing that now is to illustrate something of the features which you can find and which I'd like you to pick out of the bits of positive psychology you read. So I'm going to use this as and the next thing as an illustration. So Emmons and McCulloch in 2003, they investigated the impact of the exercise of getting participants to count their blessings by writing them down. So, in study one, once a week for 10 weeks, they had to spend some minutes a day writing something down, and the three groups were writing about things they were grateful for in their life. Hassles was about writing about things that annoyed them or upset them currently in their life. And the third one was meant to be neutral, really, about events in their life that weren't strongly positive or negative. And gratitude, on their measures, did better than the other subjects. In their second study, a similar, except that it was once a day for 16 days as opposed to once a week for a semester. We see a similar pattern. Actually, I think my slide... Nah, right, okay. So, in their study, although they got an effect on positive affect, on them feeling more cheerful, some of the other things they looked at didn't shift, or at least not reliably. And this was about, the third study was about a group of people who the rest of us would expect to be unhappy because they had a chronic neuromuscular disease of some kind. Nevertheless, gratitude had an effect there. Now, second example study. This was about writing about a single positive experience. as opposed to listing things you're grateful for, pick something that's positive and write about it. Write for 20 minutes a day for 3 days, and the contrasting groups were describing your shoes, your plans for today, or an intensely positive experience. And the interesting thing about this is this got a significant upward shift if you had the intensely positive experience task, upward shift in your mood pre and post the writing. So they filled in measures of mood once a day, once an intervention day. But interestingly, in a 3-month follow-up, these people who'd had essentially the gratitude intervention had made fewer visits to the campus health centre. This was winter, I think, in the middle of the USA, with the climate in many ways worse than Glasgow. Reflecting about gratitude, at the very least reduced hypochondria. If you want to be more positive, it reduced virus infections. So, to get you to think about this a bit more, spend a minute and write down whether you spend any time reviewing good things that happen to you. Because after all, as someone who's completely task-driven might go years and never think about good things. You know, good things are taken for granted by a truly work-driven person, and that person will just focus on things that need fixing. And that, if you want to employ someone, you probably, in the short term, want them to be like that. I mean, why spend time thinking about stuff that leads to no action? We should be driven, driven, driven. But other people, however, are more relaxed.
I did help just continuously throughout the day, write down 3 things I'm most excited about in the day.
So a regular practice of one of the versions of the gratitude exercise, right. Any other techniques? So, there's both evidence and considerable practice of this. On the other hand, in the Burton and King paper, they discuss how there's an older literature on how dwelling on negative experiences is a way of getting some release from traumatic things in the past. So, and in fact, the positive effects can be broadly similar. So, we probably haven't really understood this generally. If one can get positive effects equally, roughly speaking, from dwelling on positive and negative things. In other words, there may be something about processing, as some forms of meditation would do, that is beneficial for all kinds of content. But I'm bringing this out, not only because it's true, but because positive psychology is generally should be thought of as a new field, and that means that just because someone's got an interesting experiment with interesting results doesn't mean they've got a very deep explanatory view of it. So in other words, there may be benefits from, let's say, writing regularly about one's experiences, whereas the gratitude-focused people are focused on it's got to be about the positive. So that doesn't mean they've got a wrong result. It may mean that we have to look all the time for connections that haven't yet been well sorted out. Now, part of this we might think about as processing. Another way of talking about it that I don't instinctively like, but you can certainly find important bits of literature, is the idea that humans have to create meaning in their life rather than it somehow being given in the world, and that this reflection on important events is part of creating the meaning. And indeed, some theorists like to think about identity, our sense of ourself, and as well as other people's sense of ourself, is essentially to do with creating a life story for yourself. And now, I've clearly grown up unconsciously in a deeply scientific tradition. I hate the idea that there aren't facts in the world, that things aren't either true or not, and only really silly people and children don't tell the truth. Those of you who go into family therapy or support, like one of my sisters has, soon find themselves in the vividly reminded in nearly every professional hour that two people in a family can go through the same events and come away with utterly different meanings for those events. That simply being there together doesn't mean there's much or any agreement about the meaning of that event. Summarising, then, there are actually quite a few different formats for gratitude exercises already in the literature. Looking for benefits, counting your blessings, that is, listing things to be grateful for. Number three is not doing a list, but doing a significant piece of reflective writing on one important thing. But also, there can be a social dimension to gratitude exercises. So, whereas several people I picked on in the audience talked about just doing it in their heads and on the whole not socially, there can also be social versions of this. Writing to someone else, let's say, and even telling that person face to face. So if you look up Seligman's textbook, he mentions that in his positive psychology course, he at least once arranged for some of the people in the class each to think of someone in their past they were particularly grateful for, and got them to come and express that gratitude in front of the class to their benefactor. Now, this is obviously introducing the social dimension, which I hope I'll mention frequently, and if I don't, you should be thinking about it frequently, because, first of all, my own training and inclination is very cognitive. It's all about isolated actors. This, of course, is a very lopsided view of human psychology, and it's not a good one to unthinkingly transfer to positive psychology. Positive psychology has its own tendency to solo actors, because it's associated with self-help, with people who are unhappy and alone and wondering about what they can do themselves, as in working on their gratitude exercise by themselves. It's not that that's not valuable, but to think the whole of positive psychology is just about the self-help solo situation is leaving out this big dimension. And I was pleased that several people in the audience thinking about gratitude is something they would do perhaps in their family or socially. But the other point I want to make about that, just second from the bottom on the slide, is that in the not only social but rather public way of doing this, like four or five, it's and actually it makes us think about why you should say thank you to people and what gratitude's about. So partly, and I think there are different answers to this, and we ought to, in general, consider all of them. So a private answer is that I quite like the story that I can call it a theory if you want to be super polite to me. A theory one can have that what's the point of human minds? Well, one of the striking things about humans is that they can plan ahead, that they we can imagine a situation which is not true in the world and make it come about. And that's all about thinking in the future, making things happen. Now, most plans don't go perfectly, so in order to make even your daily life, let alone something tricky like a holiday or a whole degree course, go well, you need to be paying attention to things that go wrong. And if you stop paying attention to things that go wrong, the whole plan will derail and bad things will happen. So there's a sense in which what's distinctive about humans is our ability to manage our lives, and the most important short-term skill in that is paying disproportionate attention to things that go wrong and counteracting deviations like that. But if you generalize that, that means you live a life where your whole consciousness is about anxiously looking around for things that are going wrong and fixing them. Now, that's effective on that view of what humanity is about. But it's actually not a truth about the human situation, although it may feel like it in today's super cushioned society. Fact is, there are many things in our lives that we have absolutely no control over. We're going to die. In the end, there's nothing we can do about it. More distressing, there are going to be people in your family who die, and there's nothing you can do about that. There are many things that are out of our control, and there's something fundamentally unrealistic about having a consciousness dominated about the things that you can fix. It's utilitarian, but it's not a truth about our situation in life. So another way of looking at gratitude exercises is they're a reminder that, useful as it is to focus on the negative and do your best to counteract it, there are things which you don't control. And a lot of those are positive things as well. After all, if you're not an astronaut or a deep sea diver, you're very likely to live almost all your life never thinking, never worrying about having air to breathe. And yet that's the single most important thing in all our lives. That's the thing without which you die the quickest, about 4 minutes, the irreversible end of your brain, maybe slightly longer. Most important thing to us, but it's always there so we don't think about it. But we've done absolutely nothing to supply it, and in fact, our society is on the whole damaging the atmosphere, if anything. So there's something deeply unbalanced about not thinking about the things we don't control. And that's another sense in which gratitude could be thought of as striving for a more balanced overall view. So, we could think about gratitude as having three kinds of benefit. One, the benefit to the person giving the favour. The bottom one is the benefit to the recipient, which I've been talking about. But the middle one, the social one, is about receiving acknowledgement. So why is it important to say thank you to people? Well, besides these other things, it's actually a simple transactional thing. So, for instance, if as a clumsy uncle who's childless, trying to give a present to a child, I'm quite likely to make a mistake. And how am I going to learn if I don't get feedback from it? So it's all right with young children because they haven't yet got the idea of hiding what they feel. You look at their face and you can see within about 2 seconds whether you've made a boo-boo or got lucky with your choice of gift. But as people get older, they get more social and then they won't tell you straight. So there's something about acknowledging benefits that is actually helpful, simply to keep you in tune with whether you're actually done someone else some good or not. And although the example of giving gifts is an easy one for me to mention, actually I think it's also more general. So I think one of the features of our lives is that, but this is particularly true of teachers, but I think it's true of everyone to some extent, is you're often very unaware. So what, there's, let's say, 80 people in this room, and probably quite a proportion will think it's a waste of time listening to me, and if they learn anything, it will be from what they read, and a lot will find it moderately useful, and a few will probably find it hugely enlightening. But I have absolutely no idea, looking around, who that is. And it's easy for a teacher to get depressed and then interpret all the evidence as having no effect, or to be over-optimistic and think because I enjoy what I'm saying, that means it's valuable for everyone. It's actually mixed, and I think in life we often don't know when we're doing someone good. And a bit more feedback is actually useful in that. Another way of trying to overview gratitude. Now, another feature which is true of every single topic in positive psychology, and I'd like you to be endlessly alert to, is that something like gratitude exercises may look like a well-defined experimental procedure, a bit of variation in the particular nature of the intervention, but it looks like a topic by itself, but actually all the time I'd like you to be thinking about how it links to other issues that are also important in positive psychology. So one would be mindfulness and meditation. Another, which I'll get to later in this session, is about counteracting the tendency to catastrophize. That is the tendency many people have the moment they hear of something to, especially something unexpected and at least slightly negative, is to fill their head with the worst possible interpretation. I don't feel like getting out of bed, and my left knee aches. I've obviously got bone cancer in there. You know, that's a sort of typical catastrophization. A third issue, much wider, is that of, well, psychologists often use measures of self-efficacy. Slightly more broadly, it's about self-regulation, because although naive people think total self-efficacy is good, actually self-efficacy is about an estimate of what you can and can't do. And if you don't have a realistic estimate, you're either going to be depressed and in the end catatonic, or you're going to be manic and be quite sure you can fly, and that also leads to bad things. So a more sober way of thinking about self-efficacy is you want it to be accurate because you have to guide your behaviour, and if you don't understand what you can and can't do, you're going to make bad and in fact dangerous choices. Number four is about creating meaningfulness. Number five can relate to other issues, as you'll see later in the course. So finally, summing up in some way, aspects of gratitude as a positive psychology topic. Well, at the top there's respectable, well-conducted experiments. So this is not just a flaky, unscientific field. It's a self-help exercise which anyone can do, but there are important social forms of it. In one sense, it's a new practice. When those studies were published on gratitude interventions, it wasn't that this was a perennial experimental psychology topic, but one can equally say this is a modern secular reinvention of something that's been standard practice in most religions, and certainly in Western Christianity, where most church services will have one or more hymns of thanksgiving. So also there's a historical dimension we don't want to lose sight of. I'll just say something else. Last year I had a Maxi student, Leah Palmer. Now Leah's a sincere and practicing Christian, and her real motive, which she wasn't very aggressive at telling me what it was to see whether gratitude exercises would work on those who self-announced themselves as active spiritual people. And sure enough, unlike most of the literature, she couldn't get an effect to the gratitude exercise. And if only I'd been a better supervisor, we'd have had a proper control group with a few ordinary people to replicate the stuff we knew. But it did, basically, her data did seem to confirm that if you're a practicing religious person in the widest possible sense, you're probably doing a version of this which makes these exercises unnecessary and unable to add anything. And this, there's some other areas in positive psychology too, which are like a modern reclothing of old practices from our culture, particularly our religious culture. As one person in the audience has probably said something related to, there's aspects of the famous 12 steps practice for recovering addicts, which is about bullying them to acknowledge that they're helpless. And the thing about gratitude is it's also acknowledging that, though in a less grim context. There are things outside our control. Nevertheless, a lot of those things are not dangers, they're things which benefit us. As we touched on with Burton and King, this can have medical benefits, so this isn't just about people adjusting their pleasure in life. It also sometimes has positive effects on physical health. We probably don't understand very deeply what's going on in these cases. But also, it probably has some significant relationship to other bits of psychology theory which weren't conceived originally within positive psychology. Things about the effects of self-efficacy and self-regulation. So that's an example. So I've been using gratitude as an example of a typical topic in positive psychology, but also of how I'd like you to develop multiple ways of multiple connections to make with any topic that you focus on and decide to look into within positive psychology. Right. So, what about learned optimism or counteracting a tendency to put unnecessarily bad interpretations on events? Here's some background before I can say something a bit more precise about this. First of all, contrary to our unthinking common sense and our ordinary conversational practices, there are always multiple causes for things. It's standard in most conversations and in most newspapers, they say, why did this happen? Why did the plane crash? And what they're looking for, and what we're looking for, is a single answer, as if there was a single cause for an event. That, and it's important to stop and realise how utterly wrong that is. So, suppose I had a glass here, knock it over and it breaks on the floor. Now, that's a very simple physical event. What caused it? Well, it wouldn't happen in the International Space Station. You have to have a gravity field. We're talking causation here. None of it, there's no good blaming people for it breaking. One of the causes is gravity. You turned off the gravity, it won't break. Another is whether it falls through a reasonably unviscous medium like the air. So, for instance, if you've got your scuba gear on, you're sitting on the bottom of the sea, having a fake drink for a joke camera, if you knock the glass over, the glass will fall incredibly slowly because water's much denser. Oh, won't break then, so it's also about the medium it falls through. What's another one? The other is glasses. I'm quite clumsy. I tend to drink out of plastic glasses. Or to put it another way, having fancy wine glasses is the act of an idiot who knows nothing about human factors. It's asking for breakages. Change the material of the glass, it won't happen. Another is, of course, the floor. There's a bit of carpet here. I'd say there's a better than 50% chance of a wine glass surviving a fall from this table. But if you're in a kitchen with a concrete floor, it'll probably break from that height. So it's also about the height it falls through. And I'm just thinking about the physical causes. Now, we like to think the human mind is more complicated than O-level physics. So you can imagine when you start thinking about human causes, there are going to be a whole host of other reasons. And yes, in daily life, this is not how we think about it unless we really discipline ourselves. So in air accident investigation, in the last few decades, they've got much more sophisticated about this. They used just to say it's pilot error, and that used just to mean there was something with hindsight the pilot could have done to prevent it. Now, they may say it's pilot error, but then they'll start looking at the training they get and whether the training should be changed rather than the pilots. They'll start looking at the management. Is it that Ryanair or someone is trying to force pilot to work longer hours and not get enough sleep, and so on and so forth. So we need to realise that when asking why, the English sentence sounds as if it's asking for a single reason, but that actually, intellectually, is nonsense. There's always multiple factors. Same is true for effects. That is, anything you do has multiple effects. Even though the human who did them is probably looking for one effect, they're going to be multiple effects. So, let's see. I make an effort, cook a slightly elaborate dinner. The effect I want is delicious food. It's also going to create a lot of washing up. It's also going to cost stuff, things. It's also going to make me fat, even though I'll be happy. It'll have a lot of effects. The thing about humans doing an intentional action is very often, in all the simple cases, we have one outcome, one aspect of the effect that we care about. So we tend to say that's the effect. But actually, there are multiple effects. So jargon that gives this away is that doctors talk about side effects as if they were somehow less important than the effect they wanted. That just shows that doctors are just engineers and not scientists. If they were scientists, they'd regard all effects as equal. Making you sick and curing your cancer would be equal effects. It's only when you apply I want, I want, I want from a human point of view, when you're an engineer trying to get an effect, that you distinguish between the effect I want and the side effects, all the other costs that someone will have to bear. Now, in many simple cases, we do an action because we want one effect and we'll put up with the side effects. I'll mention two interesting caveats to that. One is, I'm convinced these days that every single thing a human does has both some kind of effect in the material world and also some learning effect. So if you're being paid to do a job, you're being paid for the material effects that come out, the reports you write, so on and so forth, but also you'll get better, even though you don't mean to. There was a used to be famous study from, I don't know, 60 years ago or so, about Cuban women working in cigar factories rolling cigars. And someone did a really longitudinal study. And once you smooth the curve, you can show that those women are still getting better, slightly better each time, after 10,000 cigars and years of work. People are always getting better at what they do with practice, even though that's not usually the effect they want. The other thing is that although many of the little things we do each day have a single purpose from our point of view, the big things in life, this is really something Freud pointed out, and he used the word over. So if you ask a question, it's like, why did you marry John as opposed to Peter? Or why did you buy this house rather than another? Why did you take this job rather than another? And the big things in life, Freud said, are usually overdetermined in the sense that there were like 9 or 10 things that were satisfied by that. And that, of course, means that if you're trying to understand someone like that, not many couples break up because a single thing that was originally a benefit has gone away. Not many people move out of a house just because one thing about it is no longer true. So certainly when I moved to Glasgow, made a list of, wanted to buy a flat to live in, made a list of the 10 things I thought I cared about most personally, and went round finding the property that was on the market then that ticked the most boxes. And that worked a treat, really. The place I got about 9 out of 10, and that still means I've just never even thought about moving because it ticks so many boxes. And And that means, too, that if my original assessment wasn't entirely right, there were still so many things about it that were right. There's really no need to review that. So the big things in life where we think in a more complicated way, simple things in life we tend not to, but the complexity is underneath. Now, as you know, there's an old psychological literature on attribution, and people famously attribute causes in irrational ways. So the fundamental attribution error is the way that a person typically explains to themselves why they did something in terms of their pressures. I shouted at that student because of being harassed at my job, but they explain other people's actions much more often in terms of their internal traits. He shouted at me because he's a bad-tempered bastard who needs my kid. So we typically attribute internal traits when explaining other people's behaviour, but external factors in ours. And the point is that neither of those are irrational. Festinger's neat experiment shows there's a systematic difference between the two styles of attribution, not that one is right and one is wrong. So, that's a kind of background. Seligman's exercise, under the heading of learned optimism, is a five-step exercise about preventing catastrophization, preventing the attribution of the worst possible interpretation of an event or of someone else's action or whatever it is. So we may make attributions about causes of events, about causes of human actions, and about the value of a given event to ourselves. So learned helplessness is about when experience of failure tends to make someone more and more expect to fail, and therefore more and more to give up acting, or give up acting in that area. And learned optimism refers to exercises that aren't about creating success directly, but they have a similar effect in combating a learned helplessness inference. And actually, in a way, it's quite closely related to cognitive behavioural therapy. That is, attacking, trying to reconstruct the thought someone has around their actions. So this is the actual steps, according to Seligman. So adversity is when the thing happens. Beliefs is that typically instantaneously generalises a negative interpretation in your mind and low expectations for the future. The consequences of that tends to be despair, helplessness and giving up, or at least a move in that direction. And the self-therapy, like CBT, is about disputing those conclusions, thinking about that thought that crossed your mind about my girlfriend turned her back on me, it's all over, and thinking more positively. Well, first of all, thinking about, well, what other evidence is there? Do I, in fact, have counterexamples that make that interpretation a poor one? And energization is the hopeful effect. So, do you tend to catastrophize? Have those instantaneous, it's all hopeless thoughts when something goes badly? And do you have techniques for resisting it that are in any way like Seligman's?
Thank you.
Yes, there is. It's just like
when you speak that. It's all the
okay, sorry about that. It's just when I asked someone at the back at the start, so I thought I was going to be all right. Okay. Anyone care to share about catastrophization? You're all positive thinkers already. What a waste this course is. In that case, I think I'll move on. What I'm going to do now is discuss the structure of the course. So I've briefly introduced three topics and tried to indicate something about the multiple ways we should attempt to think about each topic in positive psychology. So, and I'm going to talk more generally. Is my voice coming out the speakers now? No? Yeah? First of all, as long ago as 1948, the World Health Organization defined health not just as about physical health, but equally about mental and social well-being. And I think that's a good reference point to keep in mind. Quite often, well-being is a bit more preferred as a general term than happiness or something like that. And that's because we're often unaware, in some sense, of well-being. And that's partly because, at least in Heidegger's view, that what our consciousness is for is thinking about things going wrong. When things go well, you don't have to think about them. After all, who thinks about your digestion until it starts to hurt? So, well-being can work a little better as an English term when we want to be general. Right, so is it or isn't it a new field? Well, Seligman, Csikszentmihalyi, started pushing the term positive psychology around 1990 and argued that Western academic psychology had been focusing too exclusively on abnormal psychology, on frank mental illness, and almost entirely neglected healthy mental functioning. Well, that might have been true of Seligman. Of course, it isn't true of other fields of psychology like perception and so on. But that was an argument. And what's, I think, is probably true, that there had been amazingly little work since 1945 on what was healthy and what was more or less good within a reasonably healthy population. On the other hand, positive, as I've already been mentioning, positive psychology techniques very often have medical as well as happiness benefits. It's woven in with medicine. So an intermediate position might be that perhaps we should be doing more to study preventive mental practices, just as healthy eating and so on are attempts to develop practices that tend to promote physical health. So the question is, could we identify such things for mental illness? And an early landmark work by Brandon Harris, this was a study, actually would fit in with that perspective. Brandon Harris's first study was of clinically depressed women in a working class area in London, in Camberwell. And they investigated the causes, the multiple causes of that tended to make depression more likely. And they identified not just precipitating causes, like losing your home, losing your husband or whatever, but also vulnerability factors, or to put it positively, protective factors. So women with a strong family who live nearby were less likely to get clinically depressed under a trauma of equivalent power than women who are not. So that would be another way. So the main point here is that there's a sense in which there's a slogan and a focus that's new, but you can always argue that the content is old and belongs elsewhere in psychology. So what's the main nature of positive psychology as an intellectual field? Well, it attracts hobbyists and self-help people. It attracts some mad claims, but there's also some well-designed experimental work. Or to put it from a student point of view, it's bloody marvellous for an area for critical thinking. You can find rubbish work, you can find good work, and you need to critical thinking, because just because it's part of positive psychology, it's not a guarantee that it's sensible. But it's not all rubbish, so... You'll find lots of the papers are not in positive psychology journals. They're embedded in journals in other areas. It's much of the work can be seen as either in or out of positive psychology, depending on preference. Now, about this course. First of all, I don't have a runaway winner for a textbook. Got a web page listing these. These are some possibilities. The first version of first positive psychology course I taught in this university was really inspired by the Ben Shahar book, and it has lots of exercises for students to do on themselves. Seligman's most famous name, and there's no doubting he's done a lot. The thing is that Seligman thinks that he's 100 times more important than everyone else. So in his book, he almost never mentions anyone except himself. And it is true that covers a lot of ground, but it doesn't cover all the ground. So, excellent book, but you've got to bear in mind that this is Seligman's view of the field, and it's quite self-centered. These two come out of the first place that taught a whole degree, a master's degree in positive psychology, is the University of East London, and those two books are by people who taught that course. This is not so much a textbook, but still a compendium. There's probably a few new textbooks, but they probably may not be setting out to be general textbooks, but more focused on covering holes in earlier ones. Now, I want to emphasize this because there's ways in which this course is not like any of the other courses in the school. I put this on because I thought it was an area that many students in the School of Psychology would be interested in, but would never get taught, not for the next 50 years, especially in the final year, where lecturers like to teach their own research speciality, and there are no positive psychologists at Glasgow. So I thought, there's a sense in which I was creating a course on student-centered principles. Now, there are pros and cons of that. I'm not an expert, and I don't do active research in positive psychology, and it is nice in its way to talk to real experts. On the other hand, the trouble with being an expert is you exude this enthusiasm, which students rather like, but it's very hard to shut up and listen to students or to think carefully about what students need, because you want to talk about what you're interested in. There's not a problem with that in this course. For all these reasons, as well as others, I'm structuring this course not around what I deliver in lectures in terms of content. Students are going to create major bits of help for each other on this course. And I'm going to go and talk more about the main coursework in this. It's about, as it were, the class spreading out over the landscape of positive psychology and producing some starter help for other students. So the main coursework for each group, I'm going to divide you into groups of about three, mainly three. The main coursework is to jointly create a web page, which I'll be calling a wiki page because it will be done within Moodle, and that's the tool you have to use. And the aim is to be helpful to other students. So what is it to be helpful to other students? It's actually quite different from the kind of essays you're used to. So, what's useful to me in a colleague? Well, I've changed research field, changed academic discipline and topic a number of times in my life, and what I most need in entering a new field isn't a classic textbook. I can buy that and read it. What's so valuable and hard to get from reading is orientation in a field. It's someone saying unofficially to you, you don't want to listen to that, it looks respectable but it's dying, you want to listen to that, they haven't got it very good but it's clearly the coming thing, this is the most surprising stuff. You know, it's all that stuff about value judgments, about what's interesting and what you should ignore, and that's more helpful really than other stuff. So should have edited this slide. There are going to be 37 topics in this course, I think, or somewhere around that. And obviously each of you individually for the exams, then you're going to study a few of those with any depth. What kind of help would you want from others? Well, really, you want people to supply a fairly short briefing which gives you an idea of what that topic is and what kind of topic is it. That is this staid, respectable experimental work? Is this flaky but interesting stuff? Is this applied work or theoretical work? All of those things that different students will have different tastes about whether they want to focus on that for the exam. But you can't really Google. You know, if you type in positive psychology, the most interesting bit, you know you're not going to get one that actually is the most interesting bit for you. So you want to be creating and you want to be reading other people's web pages for a short briefing on a topic that gives you some real, that equips you to make a decision fairly quickly about whether this is a topic you want to focus on or not. Now, why is this different writing? Actually, it's a common kind of writing, except in universities. So the thing about, or in novels. So in a novel, you write the novel thinking all the time about the order in which the reader's reading this book, and the fact that if they don't give up, they're going to be reading it, starting at the beginning and going to the end. So in modern novels, there are often no chapters, and very rarely are there chapter titles, because novel readers start at the beginning and go to the end. Now, so far, you've, I think exclusively, will have written lots of essays and reports, and really, your subconscious understanding is that the poor old marker is going to start at the beginning and read every single word, and you don't have to think about anything else. Now, everywhere else in the world, life is different. If you think about a newspaper article, as you know, very few people read newspapers from beginning to end. They scan the titles of the article. So the title of the article has got to give the reason why you might want to read it. If the reader makes it past the title, then the paragraph, as apparently editors are always beating Cheney journalists into Cheney journalists, the first paragraph's got to essentially tell the whole story, because so many readers won't make it to the end. If you save the good bit to the end, which is a good technique in a novel, it's disastrous in a newspaper article. Now, I used to think that's because journalism was a low form of life and I would never bother with it. But now I'm a grown-up, it turns out that writing grant applications are a lot like that. If you don't have a sexy title for a proposed research grant, probably the referees won't be reading it, or certainly the committee won't be reading it with attention. You've got to have the whole, all the good bits in the first paragraph, because their attention may have gone by then, and the details come later. In other words, when I say a pyramid, at each stage, you have to motivate the reader. If there's any possibility of this reader being interested, you have to have that reason up front, because they're skinning, they're selecting. And that's what it is when you're writing these web pages. It's not writing a conventional essay. It's not giving 100 references and no clues about which ones are the important ones. It's all about focusing on readers in this way that's very common in the world, but very rare in academia. Now, here's a suggested schema. I'm not saying you have to do all of this, but this is my idea. So you will have some word or title of the topic, but think hard about whether it's good and change that to work as a title. You want to think hard about whether you can say there's... Actually, the slide might not have put it the best. The best way of putting that second bullet point is, if you only read one thing, what should it be? What's the best reference to start with if you go beyond the web page? You should get early on, but very briefly, a bit of a critique. That is because, you know, everyone in this class is and wants to be a critical thinker. And you can very quickly say about an area whether it's well-founded in an experiment, whether it's completely missing them, whether there's a lot of dodgy ones, but there are a few great ones, and these are they. All kinds of... You can pack a lot of little judgments into a couple of lines if you think about it hard enough. And it's about orienting the reader. But because this is positive psychology and there's a particular angle I want you to take, you might like to mention wild, uncritical claims, because I think to understand a positive psychology topic, you should be thinking not just about the academically best aspects of it, but also whether it's famous for any daft claims as well. You should mention whether there are practical exercises in the literature an individual could carry out. You should mention whether there's a cultural connection. You might mention the one best reference at the top. Further down, you might say, well, if you read three things, what will they be? And so on. Doesn't mean you shouldn't have a long bibliography at the end, but it's at the end because very few people will read all of it. But one or two may be very grateful for it. Right, now, this exercise isn't only about positive psychology. You'll get a chance, which you might not have had before, about creating a web page, but also about writing in, well, I'm calling a pyramid style, but that's not a phrase other people use. It's this different style of writing, which, as I say, is surprisingly widely useful. President Reagan was said to be famous for not allowing anyone to talk to him if they hadn't got what they wanted to say down on a single postcard. That didn't mean to say you didn't want to be brief with all the details if you woke him up and got him interested, but that's not your entry point. You know, it will come in all kinds of ways, having your ideas organised, being clear about what's the most important versus what's interesting only after someone's interest has been warmed up. And all these things are things you're really quite likely to find useful in professional jobs of many kinds. Okay, so, from your point of view, this is the timetable for the course. There are six, what I'm calling sessions, these 2-hour lecture slots, 1 to 5. Number 6 is the deadline for the coursework, about a week after the last session. Really, the learning is going on between the sessions, and if you don't start early, given how extraordinarily short on the calendar these courses are, you're not going to do well. You need to get going and work steadily. So, basically, what I want you to do between now and next week is to read some of the pages produced in past by past students and past versions of this course, read a handful and produce a critique, because I want you to be thinking about what you do and don't like about that, what you felt was a successful and an unsuccessful way of organising these web pages. One of the things I learned in my PhD, I read quite a few other people's PhDs because a lot of the work in my area was not necessarily in the journals it was in, PhDs, and they were of extraordinarily variable quality. And so I took a lot of notes on the things I wanted to imitate and what drove me mad, and I was determined to do better in presentation in that respect in my own PhD. I want you to have that attitude, to sample past web pages and think about and make notes to yourself on, and bring your notes next time for a bit of a discussion on, what features of these web pages seem to work well to you and what didn't. Between 2 and 3, we'll be really getting moving on substantive work on in your group. Between 3 and 4, you should get a full draft of your page up. And why do it that early? Because between 4 and 5, I want you to be critiquing other people's draft pages, and you can't do that unless most groups have produced it, and those who do produce it will get feedback which they can then use and make adjustments and get the credit for that. So that's the that's, as it were, the real timetable. Now, what do you need to do? For the last 30 minutes of this session, although this may feel a bit tedious to you, I want you to meet the other people in your group, and I'm going to be adjusting group membership depending on who's here. Please don't leave until I've successfully finalised your group, and that may take a while. I'll say how we'll go about that in a moment. Finalise the topic. The group might change from the original topic, but you can do that during the coming week. And for homework, it's the critiquing exercise, which there are more details of in the handout you can look at another time. So, Right, turn to the handout, and I'll just talk you through it briefly. First thing I want to point out, and it's at the top of the front page, is that there's a URL there for a web page which is where most stuff about this course will be. There's also going to be a Moodle, but that's not quite ready because of a technical hitch I had over the last day or two, but it will be within a couple of days, I think. I'll get the Moodle to point to this page and this page to point to the Moodle, but at the moment, well, a lot of resources anyway will be at that URL. So that's the first thing I wanted to draw your attention to. We won't go through the rest of the front page in detail, but it specifies the homework exercise for this week. It is a written version of the possible structure for a typical web page and so on. Next thing I want to talk about is the back page, this list of topics. Because I wanted a fresh go at this course, I've decided to list topics in a different way. So what I've done is I've looked at the current Wikipedia entry for positive psychology, which organises it in a quite different way than I usually do, and pretty much all the topics correspond to a subheading on that page. That's not because I feel the Wikipedia article is brilliant or anything. It's because it looks at it in a different way, and your job isn't to assume that the topic you're allocated makes brilliant sense. It's to produce a version of it. As I've already mentioned, you can actually try and structure positive psychology in many different ways, you know, as pure or applied, as about solo self-help or social. There are lots of different organisations. So all the time it's about reassembling what's out there in the literature under different headings. So looking now at your back page, the first 17, the first subset, which I called aspects of life, they're really, I've got one word like age. What's age about? It's about ideas about whether well-being and happiness are higher or lower as you get older. Gender is about, are women on average happier than men or vice versa? Personal finances are about whether money is the root of all well-being, and so on. So how you are to understand those words is, what does the psychology literature as a whole say, but what does the positive psychology literature have to say about that topic? And you may decide it doesn't have much to say, but you probably will find stuff and can get cracking on that. The second subsection, theory. Is about a few relatively broad theoretical approaches, and the group who gets one of those will attempt to provide a summary and a way in to one of those. And the last section is about applications. First one's about how you measure happiness, and others are as you see them. So that's the kind of topic it is. The Wikipedia entry has at least some references, which I'm hoping will be enough to get you started. But your other big resource is past student entries, which are available to you in links from the page. Some of them look a bit scrappy because I haven't. I had to move them out of the old Moodle, so as you'll see, the pages look a bit messy with headers and footers that don't make sense, but the body of them is sensible. And you can rifle through them, picking up bits. They won't have the same headings as you have, so you'll have to flick through a lot, but I'd be surprised if you don't often find stuff that's useful. D. Right. So, You open your handout, you get two facing pages like this. The left-hand side, when you've got it open like that, is sorted by surname, by second name. If you're on the list, then the right-hand column gives a topic number. And if you aren't on the list at all, then when I stop yakking and start getting people to move, those who aren't on that list, they could come up and fill in their details, and I'll assign you a group before you leave, hopefully. The right-hand page is the same list, but it's sorted now by groups. So top left, you see group one and the three people who have been provisionally assigned there. The next one's group two and so on. So you can see who else is meant to be in the same group as you when I was assigning things in a vacuum. So what I now want to do is to give you a chance to meet people in your group, but because I think there's quite a lot of people missing, I'm going to try and shuffle people so that those who are here end up in a group of three, and I'll deal with the rest later, some of whom will be phantoms and some just don't turn up. So I know this is going to be a pain, but I think it's going to be worth it. I basically want you to line up in the aisle in the group. So those in group 1 want to be right up here. Those in group 37 press themselves against the black wall. Halfway up will be group 20. If you talk to people either side of you, you should be able to adjust yourself. And I'm going to come round and try and make sense of it all. Yeah, let's say a group like that.